Hopefully you're here for this talk, Jenna Kafka-Mina, Configuration Management Using Apache Components. So, come on, go to the, I'll get this right. Let me start again, all right, first off, I'm Claude Warren. I am not the one on Wikipedia, that would be my father. Feel free to look him up. I'm a foundation member. I'm a member of the Jenna Project Management Committee. I'm a software engineer, developer, as it says up here. Formerly, I have been a project manager in the past, and I have been what IBM called a systems engineer. My interest is solution-based reduction strategies. We can talk about that later. I've had papers published on various topics, including linked data processing, Bloom filter indexing, and innovative environments. I'm a mad scientist. I'm one of the founding members of the Denver Area Mad Scientist Club. You can look that one up too if you want. And I'm a musician, mostly a frustrated musician, but I'm a musician. So that's me. And now what I really want to talk to you about is a gentleman by the name of Louis A. Von Till. Now, I know that's not part of the topic, the subject, but the topic of this talk supposedly, but we're going to start here. He was an engineer and an inventor. He invented that bottle cap. That's the bottle cap that you probably know from your ketchup bottle, where it turns about a third of a turn and it locks and won't go any further. So that's his patent illustration from when he submitted that one. He has an entry in the Encyclopedia Metallum, which is the encyclopedia for people who have things to do with metal music. So if you're in the if you've been in a metal band or something like that, you might have an entry in the Encyclopedia Metallum. So he's got that. He also happens to be my grandfather, or he was my grandfather. And he used to ask when I didn't see him very often, because we lived on opposite coasts. But when I saw him, he would ask me one of three questions. And the first question that I remember him asking me is, what do you know? Now, if you're a little kid and your grandfather says, what do you know? You have no concept how to answer this. This is one of the most difficult questions you will ever come across as an eight-year-old. Okay? But I know that all projects have a problem statement. And so, this is my problem statement. We have devices here in yellow in a secure zone. That is, there's a firewall, that red line. And there are configurations on those devices, and I want to look at those configurations and make sure that they are that they meet some minimum requirements or that they don't do things they aren't supposed to do. And then I also want to know, you know, if I find one of these, I want to alert. I want to send an alert out so somebody can look at this stuff. And if possible, I really would like to propose a fix, maybe fix it automatically, or at least give some kind of hint to the operator about what the solution might be. Okay, so what else do I know? I know I can solve that problem, because I are an engineer. All right, so let's start with the project boundaries. We have a configuration. This is an abstract concept in that, you know, you can talk about a configuration for an application or a device if you're looking at network devices, and you kind of have an idea of what that means. But in terms of our application, we're talking about any digital object that you can pull from a device. That could be an LS in Linux. It could be, you know, anything that you can think of, you can get to a device, type some command, do something, get result back. That result coming back, we're going to call that a configuration. So, wide open. Our application is not going to do monitoring. Something else will monitor. It will tell us that something is perhaps different, perhaps wrong. Go look, and we'll go look. The application, once it's goes out and checks, it'll determine if there has been a change in whatever that configuration is. And then it will, if there is a change, it will contextualize those changes so we have some idea of what that means. I mean, if you think about changing one element in an XML document, if I just tell you the element name foo changed, that doesn't give you any context. That could be, you know, you could have hundreds of foos in your XML document, and it's where they are in the tree that makes the, that tells you what, why it's important and what it's really doing. And so we need to contextualize that change and say, oh yeah, it's here in the tree. So we need to, we're going to do that. That's our, one of our goals. And we're going to apply machine learning to analyze these changes to see if we can project what the proper solution is when we, when we encounter something that seems to be out of bounds. Okay, so now I have identified the datum that the system will handle, so I now know that. And I have identified how those data will be used. Okay, so now I can come back to my problem statement and make a solution statement. So this is what my architecture looks like at this point. We have our previous diagram, and we've added to that this idea that we're going to have a thing called an edgent. Now, this is not the Apache edgent project. This is just a name that we gave to this device, this piece of, it was a device sitting in the secure zone. It's going to talk to the devices. Now, in our case, the environment we were working in, all those devices talked SSH, so we're going to use MINA for that because it's a nice SSH package. We're going to do some blob storage because the device has, our edgent has to be able to tell if the thing has changed, so we're going to store something that tells us what it looked like before so we can tell if it changed. We're going to use Kafka to cross the firewall because Kafka means if we use Kafka, we only have to open one port, and we can secure both ends of that port. We can do, you know, key authentication. We can do all kinds of things that are going to make the security team happy. I mean, security teams are never happy when you punch a hole in the firewall, but if you can go and say, just one, and we'll be really careful, they're a little more likely to let you in. Okay, so then, on the other side of the Kafka, we're going to put together a service network, and then we'll keep that nebulous for the moment, but it'll be powered by Apache stuff. There will be lots of Apache stuff in there, no doubt about it. We're going to store the some data in Jenna, which is an RDF framework, and it has a component called Fuseki, which is a web-based engine that you can run queries against and do data loading and all kinds of nice things. It's basically a Fuseki is a RDF server. Okay, and we're going to have some blob storage because, well, some of the stuff we're storing isn't going to fit and isn't going to map well into the Jenna stuff. We could store it there, but it really doesn't make sense. We're going to store it in this blob storage, and you know, we're not too concerned about what that looks like. It's just we're going to store stuff there. Okay, so the second question my grandfather would ask me, what don't you know? Okay, now if you're an 8-year-old kid and you've tried to explain what you know, this is a much harder question. Where do I even begin? But what don't I know here? I don't know what the devices are I need to talk to. I have some idea that there are devices beyond the firewall and that I'm going to talk SSH to them, but I don't really know what they are. I don't know how big the configurations are. They could be really small, you know, JSON-type documents. They could be multi-megabyte documents that come out of routers and things like that. I have no idea exactly how big my configurations are. I don't know where this solution is going to be deployed. Okay, I know there's a firewall, so I know there's some bits and pieces to it, but is it all on-site, on-premise? Is it most of it up in the cloud someplace? Is it some kind of mixed configuration? So there's a lot of pieces there that we don't understand where, you know, what kind of impacts those are going to have on this architecture. Okay, so now if I'm a project manager, been one of those, then I'm pretty happy because I know what I know, and I know what I don't know. And I even know I have known unknowns and I have unknown unknowns, and now I can plan, and everything is good. But there's something missing. And this is my grandfather's third question. What do you know that ain't so? Turns out that this is actually the most important question in any project, because this is the stuff that'll trip you up. All right. So I know that I've identified this, what the system is going to handle, the data, where it's coming from, all of that. But the data is dependent on the devices, and since I don't know what the devices are, I really don't know what the data are. And I also know from experience that demands on data change over time. As soon as you put data out there and you think, hey, this is what people are going to use this for this thing, management or somebody else will come along and say, wow, we can twist it this way and we can do something else with it. So now we've got another use case. So you never, in my opinion, you can never know what the demands on your data are going to be, who's going to use it and how. And so we get to identifying how they will be used. I note that if you have N developers, you have 2 to the N solutions for any given problem. If you have N people who are handling data, you have 2 to the N ways that they're going to use that data. So things that I thought I knew that just aren't so. And finally, you can't future-proof this because the future is a vast and undiscovered country. So what do we do? We did RDF all the way down. And now I can hear some people out there going, RDF? What's RDF? So we'll take a little side journey here. RDF is the Resource Description Framework. It's a W3C recommendation. You can consider RDF, RDF is a set of triples. In general, you think about having a set of triples. You can think of each triple as being a declarative sentence, a very simple declarative sentence. It has a subject, it has a predicate, it has an object. Your subject has to be a URI or an anonymous node, and we're going to ignore anonymous nodes for the moment. They're really difficult to work with outside of the RDF infrastructure, so we're just going to ignore them for the moment. A predicate is always a URI, and the object is either a URI or one of those anonymous nodes we're going to ignore, or a literal, so you know the number 5. Okay. So as an example, I'm going to define 3 prefixes here. If you're familiar with XML and used to using namespaces in XML, you'll recognize that sort of structure. So it's shortening the URIs for me so I can make it this much easier to read down here. And you'll note that if you go to the URL that's the prefix of Apache and then put Claude on the end of that, you'll find me. That's my record on the Apache Committer Index. Okay, so I can say that URI has a name, and I'm using friend of a friend because it's a common, well-known name scheme. And so it has a name, Claude Warren. That's me. Okay. The Apache Claude object there also has a friend of a friend has current project, and that current project is an ApacheCon North America talk. Thank you for attending that project. And then, just as another example here, if you go to the ApacheCon website, speaker number 2038 is also me. So here I say that is the same as the Apache Claude. So this gives you an idea of what the RDF structure looks like. And if you think about this for a moment, you will realize that that's a graph. And it has some really interesting properties in the graphs in that each of the predicates can also work as objects. They can work as objects too, but they can be subjects. So you can have things about FOF name if you wanted to. But this is what RDF looks like and how you can think about it. The important piece to remember is that everything is namespaced. Except the literal objects, and even those can have data types that are namespaced. So it's RDF all the way down. Now that we've done our detour, this system that we've designed is event-driven. So something's going to say, I think something changed. That's the event. That event's going to flow through the system. We can give that event a UUID to make sure that we can identify it as it moves forward. This is handy because there is a UUID URN namespace, so it's very easy to map all those into URNs. So I've got my URI for the system event. The events have properties. One of those might be the time the event occurred. It could be where in the network the event occurred, what IP address, things like that. all those properties we would give a namespace value URI to, and then obviously the property. In our system, we wanted the users to be able to add arbitrary data. If you think about it, we're building a tool here that's going to plug into some other infrastructure because something is going to figure out that perhaps something has changed in the infrastructure and we need to go look. So it seems as though the user is going to want to be able to say, which of my processes told you to go look? Okay, and they can do that very easily. In our case, they do it on the front end when they actually make the call. They can put a namespace property in there and a value. So they can say, oh, here's my namespace for my, you know, my company namespace. And I have a property called the process. And this process detected this is the process that names the process that detected the change. So I can put process and then process foo. So I know my foo process discovered the potential change and made the event. And then, so we attach that to the system event. And that's going to flow all the way through the system and all the way back out the other end, and the user's going to be able to query against that to see, you know, which of the events were triggered by foo processes and which events were in the last half hour were triggered by the foo, or, you know, all sorts of things. They can do other things as well. I mean, anything the user can dream of putting at the front end, they can put it in as RDF, and it'll flow all the way through the system. Okay, and our system is going to add properties as the event flows through. So we're going to put a timestamp on it for when did we create this event. We're going to put a timestamp on it that says where was it created, which service node created the event. It's going to have some other stuff, like which device was reported that was changed, so we know where to go with the event. That kind of information goes into the metadata for the event. It can add other namespaces depending on how we've configured this thing. So if you think about this, the event itself is a small RDF graph. Okay. So we have small RDF graph coming from the front end, moving through the system. All right, well, now the system also handles metadata about configurations. You know, when did I read this configuration? What kind of device, what kind of device did it come off of? What is its format? You know, is it text? Is it XML? Is it, you know, what? How big is it? And maybe I want to know how big it is before I go try to read it. So there's all these properties that go with the metadata. So they have properties that are URIs, obviously. And metadata objects, we could name them by UUIDs. We could do some other naming structure to get names to them. But we'll go ahead and use UUIDs, and we'll attach names to the UUIDs so that the user can change the name later if they want to, things like that. You know, that future-proofing thing. Okay. And then the other part is that metadata objects can reference other metadata objects. So I might have a configuration, and I might have a metadata for the device the configuration came off of. Sort of like you think about a relational table sort of idea. So we have these small graphs are now pointing to each other and containing each other. So they're actually a little bit larger than the events, but they're smallish graphs. We've defined all of our data that we think we're going to process in terms of the metadata around the configuration. We're going to do an RDF. All right, so now here we are again, back to our solution statement. We have, we'll start at the other side this time. So the request comes into the service network and we create an event that's got creates the UUID and whatever information the user gave us about what this device is and who designed it, whatever information they want to put into it. We put that on Kafka and it goes across and the agent looks at it and says, yes, I handled that one. It's going to use MINA to fire up an SSH connection and talk to the device and get the configuration back off of it. And pull that configuration back. It's going to do a diff on it. We'll do a binary diff and determine whether or not the configuration has changed. So we're going to store the configuration, local configuration, in the blob storage, and we can be able to tell whether or not it's changed. So the and then it'll send the change data, actually a patch file, back across the service network, along with all the metadata that it's added to. The initial event and all of that. And all of the metadata goes into Fuseki, and all of the non-metadata goes into the blob storage. Okay, so what do I know about RDF now? I know that it is an infinitely extensible data format that describes things. I know that even values have type, so I can have an integer type and a long type, and I can define types that match to small, you know, enums and things like that. Very easy to map to an enum, a type in RDF, so you can actually distinguish first of one enum and first and another type of enum from each other. And I know that when I combine two RDF graphs, I get a bigger graph. I still get one. This is 1 + 1 = 1. We're doing graph stuff. What don't I know? Well, I don't know how to extract from the big graph the smaller piece once I put it in there. So if I want to look at one configuration, that configuration has an event that goes with it, and it has a device that it was drawn from, and that device probably has other events associated with it. So, you know, maybe a device has multiple types of configurations, which that's a possibility. So if I say, well, give me back this configuration, all the metadata for this configuration, where do I stop in the graph traversal and say, yeah, that's enough, that's what the user's asking for? Don't know how to do that. And what do I know that ain't so? Well, when we started this, we looked at the output that Fuseki would give us and said, oh, look, JSON linked data. Ooh, great, JSON. That's what the UI people want. And RDF, we can serialize it out as JSON linked data. That'll work perfectly. The UI people were not really happy with that decision. So we did have to backtrack on that. But that's what I thought I knew, that it wasn't so. Okay, we get to Kafka. What do we know about Kafka? Well, it's a payload agnostic queuing system. Put stuff in it, moves it around, comes back out. I know I can tunnel through firewalls with it. That's why I picked it. I know that it can distribute messages. I can put a message on the queue, and it'll distribute it to multiple receivers, multiple listeners. And it'll decouple the producer from the consumer so that you can do decoupled processing across opposite sides of the firewall, in fact, in this case. What don't I know? Well, I don't know how to serialize large objects through Kafka. And what do I know that ain't so? Well, you know, Kafka's a queuing system. It must have a priority queue in it, right? I can define something that'll just automatically pull them off in the right priority. Maybe not put them in a different order. Okay, well, the last one wasn't true either. So, all right, so now we're back to our solution. Now in our service network, we have loosely coupled services that are basically processing RDF transactions, RDF messages through Kafka. So Kafka is, we're putting all the RDF on Kafka, and then the next piece can pull it off and read it and enhance it, look up stuff that's in it, do whatever you need to do, and then it's going to put stuff on queues and send it on out, and we'll have some APIs that are exposed over REST that'll let you pull data out. And so now that the service framework is now very loose, and if the customer wants to add some other feature, something else is going to listen, some custom piece they want to do, they can listen to the RDF and pull the data out and make it work for them. And again, we're writing the RDF into Jenna, into Fuseki, so we can run Sparkle queries against it, which is a lot like running SQL queries against the database, a relational model database. And we have the blob storage to store the configuration that's coming off the devices, except that the agent isn't sending us the full configuration all the time. The agent is going to send us the full configuration the very first time, and after that, it'll send us either a patch file that'll tell us how to get from the one that the agent sees to the earlier one, or it'll send us a note that says, no, there wasn't a change, somebody's mistaken here. So those are the three possible things that the agent's going to discover, send across on Kafka, service side's going to process that. So in our blob storage, we can now have a history of changes. So we actually give you changes over time. We can go back, like any good versioning system, we can go back and tell you what the thing looked like last week when it was actually in compliance. We can show you, basically tell you what changed over the course. Okay. So, what don't I know about MINA? Now, I haven't said a whole lot about MINA. MINA is this SSH transport. It's really nicely done, to be honest. It's bulletproof. It seems to be bulletproof. But it's a framework that provides the SSH implementation so we can talk to our devices. It supports authentication, both key and password ID, and actually open with no authentication at all. What I don't know is where to find the MINA SSHD documentation. And, you know, I wrote this talk a couple weeks back, and there's this thing that says don't point your finger at anybody, because when you point to something, you have three fingers pointing back at you. And I put this up here because I couldn't find the MINA documentation. But as I think I said at the beginning, I work on the Apache Jenna project, and just before I came here, there was a discussion, actually a defect open for the lack of documentation for a component that I contributed to the Jenna project. So don't point fingers because you have three pointing back, but I think that the biggest problem that we have overall, actually, in Apache is, in many cases, a lack of documentation or difficult to find the documentation. And we have these discussions online now about, you know, do we grant special status to people who just do documentation? Do we make them committers? And all of those things. Think about that for your project, because it is really important to be able to use your tool. It doesn't do a darn bit of good if you've got the best tool in the house if nobody knows how to use it. I did manage to find the documentation. It just took me a while, and I did manage to figure out how to make it work. Okay, so what do I know that ain't so? Well, I thought that MINA would tell me when the end of the transmission in the middle of the session occurred. So I would send a command out, and the SSH would send this result back, and then there would be something that would say, oh yeah, it's done, process that. Well, it doesn't, because SSH doesn't. You can figure it out if you know what the prompt is and things like that. So you can work around it, and that's what we did. Also thought that it would handle reconnecting after a connection drop. So if the other end dropped it, maybe it would just reconnect. I couldn't find a way to do that. Maybe it does, but it doesn't really need to. You can work around that. Okay. Casablanca. As time goes by, we discover that some devices will drop the connection on an invalid command. So if we are in our process, we would connect to the device, and we would say, okay, I think that's a Cisco device. I think that's a Cisco router. So let me send some Cisco commands to it. I'd send a command to it, and if I got errors back, then, okay, it's not a Cisco device. Or if I didn't get back what I expected, maybe it's not a Cisco device. Some devices, if you talk to it in the wrong vocabulary, it panics and just closes the connection on you. So we had to handle that. MINA doesn't detect it right away because the way the processing works in the whole system. But you can work around it, and we did that. We also discovered that some devices have very large configurations on the orders of hundreds of megabytes. And I don't know why anybody designs a device this way, but you ask it for its configuration, and it'll take 2 hours, and it'll send you back a very large document. I don't know why. I would think you would break that down into smaller pieces or something, but that's the way it worked. We discovered that Kafka, as you would expect, has an upper limit on the message size. Also discovered that you cannot determine what that upper limit is from the client side unless you just go through and start putting bigger chunks on the queue until it goes, no, too big. There's not any way that I could find to query and get that size, which would be really handy, and it's on my list of things to try to implement. So we developed a technique for splitting large messages into smaller chunks and move them across transmissions, just like you do with TCP messages, but bigger. There is no priority queue implementation in Kafka. I thought about implementing one of those as well. We handled that in code slightly differently. And then the other thing we found was that when you get lots of RDF data, you can approach, you add a schema-like information to it, you can get very large graphs that start to approach the limit, some of the reasonable limits that people set for Kafka. So we had to handle that like we would other large Kafka messages and split it up and send it through the queue that way. Okay, so here we are again. We have the user enters the request, says, I think something's changed, it's gone across, the agent uses MINA, talks to the thing, hopefully doesn't get hung up on, figures out how to talk to that thing, what it is, classifies it, said, yep, it's a Huawei device, great. Gets the configuration, stores it to storage, passes it back next time around, it comes, gets the configuration, looks to see if there's a difference, no, nothing changed, who thought that was a bright idea? Comes back around the next time, says, oh yeah, something changed here, it's this line of the configuration, sends that across the network to the service network. Service network then is looking at these messages coming back, going, oh, here's a new one, let's put that in the blob storage, we'll put the stuff into the metadata into Jenna. Oh, there wasn't a change, well, that's just a metadata change in the Jenna side, we're going to record that occurred. And we're going to get the patch version, so now we have to apply the patch and create the new data and then be able to deal with that inside the network, save the diff file or the patch file out on the blob storage, note that all of this occurs in the Jenna Fuseki. Inside that service network, we're going to look at things. We're going to contextualize that change now. We're going to be able to say, yes, the foo node changed, and it was this 18th foo node over here in this chain of XML elements, and therefore, it's now out of compliance. Send an alert out so that somebody will come fix that. Then that was the simple one. Change the alert, send the alert out. That's real simple. So our next part then was to say, well, can we figure out what that change might mean so we don't have to send an alert to everybody? Okay, so maybe that change is actually a change in the firewall setting. We can just now alert to people who are interested in firewall stuff. We'd use the machine learning to do that. Nice, trained a nice setup to understand which contextualized messages meant what. And then we added some other features where they were able to send commands back through the system to the agent to run on the device to say, fix that. And now we have a round trip. So now we can start looking at all the commands that go in and look at the results that come back and figure out which commands map to which result. We think we never got there because the project got shelved before we got that far. But here we have the basic infrastructure, monitoring devices, and using Apache open source components. And it works. Originally, what this was to do, use for large scale network components that were sitting in secured zones. Shortly after we got it working, it became very apparent that this was not the only use case for this. It turns out that a lot of times your IoT device sits in a secure zone and you might want to talk to it. And some of those talk SSH, so they would use MINA. Some of them, you might want to use MQTT and process that, so we could plug in an MQTT component. I think there's one in Apache. But the idea was that you can then deal with the different types of things back here behind the firewall, and the whole thing would work still. So we can talk to basically anything that talks IP, you could put this over the top of and manage the configurations of those devices. And so now we're dealing with lots of data that we never considered way back at the beginning. So what did we do? We showed that RDF provides a contextual framework for data exchange within a system. A lot of people use JSON, and if you think about it, if your JSON is dealing with one specific thing that it's describing, the JSON, and you basically name value pairs. I shouldn't say JSON, but name value pairs. If your name value pairs are dealing with one specific thing that it's describing, you've effectively taken the subject off of the triple, and you're looking at the predicate and the object, right? And you've also stripped off the URI front half for the predicate. So the predicate then is just a short name. But effectively, name value pair lists look a lot like RDF. And what the RDF gives us is a way to look at multiple things at once inside the structure. Open source component speed development, absolutely. We didn't have to write any of that stuff to go through the firewall. We didn't have to do all of the low-level niggly stuff to talk the SSH. We didn't have to write the Sparkle query engines or any of those great things. We were able to use all of those tools. We used lots of the open source, you know, all the commons components throughout the project. Documentation is lacking. I don't think there's anybody that would argue that for the general case. I'm sure there are exceptions to that as well. And any sufficiently complex library or tool will be used in ways that the architect or developer never imagined. So we were looking at doing this for specific environment, and by the time we were done, we had people coming to us going, can I use it for this, can I use it for that, can I use it for the other thing, and we really couldn't ever say no to most of those things. I think somebody wanted to make coffee, and it's like, okay, if you have an IP enabled, if you have a coffee machine that we can talk to, we can make it make coffee. So, yeah. All right. And that's it, actually. That's the end of my talk. That's what we did and how we did it. There are open sources that were developed as part of this project are available on GitHub. There are some things that were not open source, but I have them on my GitHub listed there if you want to come take a look. I have publications that are found on ResearchGate if anybody was interested in some of the publications I've got on Bloom filters and things like that. And there's my LinkedIn account if anybody wants to get hold of me there. So, are there any questions? Okay. Well, thank you. Appreciate your attention.